Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So this meditation is this last one is a very good example of how one might meditate. I was talking with a friend that, when you have a retreat center where everything is like the everything's really nicely set up, well organized, you have your own room, you have a large shrine room with stable temperature, a nice Buddha rupa, so everything's very nicely organized, and then you float from your room to the shrine, to the walking from your room to the shrine, have a shower. It's all kind of very nicely set up, and there's a tranquility that ensues from that after you get used to not having internet. But there's a kind of tranquility which ensues from that, which is circumstantial, and it just basically it comes from sense deprivation. That's all it is, really. And I like it. I enjoy that, no doubt about it. I like that kind of possibility. But this retreat, just like the tent, is more like ordinary life. You get like, I was feeling far too hot. Just roasting, dripping away here. And then, the wind comes and tries to tear the tent apart, and loud noise, quiet noise, and so at least you don't hear the next person breathing beside you. But it's very stimulating in some way, isn't it? The stimulus is very, very strong. So if your perception of meditation is low-level stimulation, if that's what meditation is, then what do you do with life? What do you do with ordinary life? You blame ordinary life. You think if life wasn't stimulating, I would be happy. Can you live that way? Is that possible? It's not, is it? So certainly, we might eventually have a meditation all which would be very tranquil and very still and so on and so forth. But I think it's this meditation is a very good example that if you don't understand desire, and your investment in your life is in the qualities of experience, that's what desire seeks. It seeks quality of experience. So it wants a stable temperature, perfect for your body, not for other bodies, and all the rest of it. That's what desire does. Tries to maximize pleasure, minimize pain in various ways by having things which are interesting or tranquil or exciting or beautiful, and then rejecting that which is boring or uninteresting and ugly, too noisy, right? So desire goes out to objects, being caught up with characteristics of objects, and by objects I mean all sense experience. So sounds are objects, and it's not just about furniture. It's that which furnishes your mind. Emotions are objects, bodily feelings are objects, temperature is an object, because they are objects of awareness. And what we do when we pursue desire is we're trying to furnish the mind with the maximum kind of aesthetic possibility. But Nibbana is about an unfurnished mind. You're not going to IKEA. Nibbana isn't the ultimate IKEA. It's the unfurnished mind. And what is the unfurnished mind? Well, it's when you do the other. So I was saying yesterday or this morning, whenever, that when there is the interest or pursuit or preoccupation with qualities of sense experience, then your mind is attentive in that way. Whereas when you are aware of change, you're emphasizing the knowing or awareness, and that is unfurnished. Awareness has no furniture in it. Awareness knows furniture, if we're to use that silly simile. So when we follow desire, we emphasize objects. When we contemplate, when we can sustain the awareness of change, we emphasize the knowing. All objects, all experiences point to the knowing, but not all experiences are pleasant. In this meditation, when it was very, very hot, my preference was for coolness. So my desire mind was not pleased with the heat. So that created resistance. So my desire mind was resisting the heat. And if it was, you know, if it was unhealthy, I would have got out of here. I knew it was unhealthy. So then I watched resistance as a changing phenomena and heat as a changing phenomena. And that kept bringing me back to the peace of the way things are. The loud sounds of the wind. If I find loud sounds to be disturbing to my meditation, and that's an interesting word, this is disturbing my meditation, what am I saying? I'm saying that I am desiring certain types of sounds and not wanting other types of sounds, and actually I'm caught in the preferences of the desire mind. But if I see that all sounds point to awareness, and I sustain awareness of change, then loud or soft, it doesn't matter. Loud or soft, it doesn't matter. Hot or cold, it doesn't matter. If cold makes me sick, yes, it matters. If heat makes me sick, yes, it matters. But just in the normal way, circumstantial kind of things, that sense of abiding with all things with an equal mind is the idea of equanimity. And that's the thing, very important principle, that like I've heard in America that they have some really posh retreat centers, you know, where people pay big bucks and they expect a kind of Club Med experience, right? I mean, if you pay your money, you expect something like that. But what does that do to the mind? It's not a meditative mind, it's a shopping mind. I want to furnish this experience with the appropriate beaches. I want a lovely sun hat for my experience too, so I'll go shopping beforehand, or whatever it is. And so that's all, you know, that's all kind of very worldly, very, very material. And certainly it would be pleasant, it could be pleasant, so on and so forth. But what is renunciation? And renunciation is an interesting idea. Renunciation isn't kind of shaving your head and wearing a brown robe. That's an outward manifestation of renunciation. That's a kind of icon of renunciation or a symbol of renunciation. But what is it, you know, what is it in your heart? It's when you see that all objects are unsatisfactory, that's not where it's at, that's not where your spiritual center lies, and that all objects conversely point to awareness. And when you can sustain awareness of change, and you can do that for long periods of time, what begins to dominate is the knowing rather than the quality of the experience. When, you know, before we started awareness practice or mindfulness practice, what dominated our life? It was the quality of experience. The excitement or the boredom, the confusion or the pain or pleasure. So our minds were very much out all the time. And then at some point, through disinterest, through suffering, through teachings that we learned, through epiphanies that we saw in our own hearts and minds, and we began to see that firm grip on sense experience is suffering. And yet, not to reject sense experience. So I opened up the flaps because I think it's more comfortable. So it's not a rejection of sense experience, it's just knowing the limits of sense experience. Knowing it's that is not what life is only about, that there is more to it. If one then takes that attitude, and then cultivation is all the time, and just the very idea that this is not a good place for meditation, it might be true, yeah, Syria is probably a difficult place to practice meditation, certainly, but on the whole, in normal existence, you know, where does the practice not exist? Where does the practice not exist? So if the mind begins to, like what I find sometimes on, not this kind of a retreat, but when I'm at a retreat center, people quite often, like they compare the menu from the last experience, right? So the menu becomes important. Wow, it's a great retreat. The food was fantastic. And I think, okay, the food was fantastic. Or, you know, so it's always like the sense experience was fantastic. The beaches were great, you know, or something like that. Whereas, certainly what it seems to me that the spiritual life is not a fantastic experience. It's the deep peace which knows all experience. So it's this kind of reversal of attention. And if you get a hold of that, then you begin to use the very things that tend to upset you the most, the memories that upset you the most, the characteristics which really get you caught up in ego a lot. So if you're a very kind of, if we all have temperaments. You know, I have temperaments which are domineering. I have temperaments which are acquiesce very easily depending on people. I can feel upset about things. I can be bored. So there's a whole series of temperaments that any human being experiences, and the strongest ones create the strongest ego, don't they? The strongest sense of me and you, self and other. So part of my temperament is to be very obsequious or I really acquiesce very easily to things, and someone comes who's very powerful and domineering, and I kind of put my tail between my legs, and they're very domineering. Or the other, there's someone as soon as I see them, I like to dominate them and crush them down with my energy. Those are extremes. Those are obviously the very, very places that one needs to learn how to not grasp those things, because those strong tendencies towards ego and self are the greatest sources of suffering, both for oneself and for others. So the very person that might inflict on me a sort of dominant energy that might create in me a very strong submissive side, say, that very person is teaching me about that strong submissiveness. And to actually stay with that mood of mind, but not buy into it, but just see it as a mood, you can do that by saying that even this submissive, frightening little being points to the knowing. You don't have to become brave. That'll take care of itself. Or vice versa, if a person is in certain situations very domineering, they like power, they like to dominate and tell you what's going on, then that person, and that's also difficult, is that person has to have enough awareness to say that energy also is deluding, because it's just a kanda, it's just a formation, and the pursuit of that is suffering. And it always, though those really strong things, it's always a strong sense of me and mine, right? Self and other. So whether I'm afraid or there's arrogance or whatever it is, it's a strong sense of self. And that is the warning bell. If there's a strong sense of me and other in the mind, then that should be a warning bell to say, okay, this is a time to be very careful, be very aware, be very mindful, and try to be with this now, be with this energy, and not believe in it. Just see it as something changing. And if you can do that, then the ego dies. Then that strong alienation which we have with others, that dies. Fear dies. Arrogance dies. These things all pass away, and the mind has a kind of natural openness and adaptability. But to go through those corridors of habit and not get caught up into them is a very mature kind of work. You know, it's something that you have to really take responsibility for. So one of the ways I have contemplated those different, because like being a senior monk, I have a lot of authority and power, and I can see that if I want my way, I can quite often be dismissive of the other monks. Try not to be, because I know that they'll all leave me. So I have a vested interest in this. But I can see in myself this tendency that says, you're junior, shut up, I'm right, because I want my way. I want my way. I'm trying not to be so overt about it. I think I'm more skillful at it. But it is a tendency. It is a tendency. But what that produces is strong alienation. It doesn't produce companionship or beauty. And it reinforces the ego in that way. Or vice versa. The other, which might come, it doesn't come so much, but it might be with some great teacher that I would always feel inferior to. You know, be the little puppy. Oh, you're wonderful and I'm horrible kind of thing. But that's also a conceit. That's also ego. And to watch any of that as a mood of the mind, just to notice the mood of the mind, how do you do that? You watch it as a changing khanda. You watch it as a changing condition. And if I've not practiced that, it's very hard to do. I just get caught in that particular ego pattern that I'm used to doing. I used to do a thing with my love of Lompo Cha. I'd say, why can't I treat everyone like Lompo Cha? That's a really good teaching. You know, like if I revere him in a very sincere way, why can't I revere this person who I'm now dumping on? And obviously I can't. You know, Ajahn Chah had his karma of being a really amazing being who just evoked in you the best, the very best behavior. But still, it was a good reflection to see, well, this is a human being. Why do I have a preference to teach, to dominate one person and then to elevate another person? What is that? What is that in me? You know, it was ego, really ego. So last night I was saying that when strong sense of ego arises, when strong sense of self arises, for me it's always in thought, right? It's just the mind doing its number on whatever the mood is. And so the suggestion yesterday, just to repeat, is to go to the tenderness of the heart. You know, the heart has a very kind of soft, humble possibility, which you cannot do through thought. You cannot make yourself humble through thought. You can direct your mind to let go of arrogance, but you can start to feel the humility and tenderness of the heart with many beings. So those beings that you feel tender towards, recognize that. Recognize that heart which is not alienated, that heart which is not putting down, not separating, not afraid of, that heart which is connected. That's non-alienation. That's non-suffering. It's not ego. Register that, and then when it goes the other way, say, ah. And so what's happening now? Become aware of the mood of the mind. So in Buddhism, we encourage the wholesome, and we also abandon the unwholesome. And sometimes we don't notice the wholesome. It's there. And when you do something with generosity, when you offer some food, when you sincerely take care of someone, just that sincere open softness of life, right? And then when I put someone down, when I cut into them with humor, when I speak behind their backs in ways which are not skillful and cruel, what's that feel like? And this is not saying that you shouldn't do that, but just get the feeling. Get the feeling. What's the feeling like? I think all of us know that those feelings of arrogance or putting down are very alienating. They don't lead to peace. They don't lead to connection. You know, they lead to fear, actually, because if I put others down, then I'm going to think other people are putting me down. It's just the way the mind works. And so to go to that, to learn how to develop this area, I think is very, very important. And then to see when the ego comes up, can I return to that? Can I return to that in all situations? And that becomes a constant reference point for your emotional life. And we call it the Brahmaviharas. So that's the kind of classic way we lay it out. We lay it out: goodwill, metta, compassion, karuna, mudita, gladness or joy, and upeka is peacefulness. And those are nice, very, very good concepts. But I think it's much more simple if you just go to the body. you can remind yourself of that. But like when you look at nature and you see, say, the chipmunks, aren't they great? You know, they've got bouncing around, getting ready for winter. They're fantastic creatures. What does your heart feel like? It feels gladness, doesn't it? Because it's, unless it's it's in your room or something like that. But the heart feels, well, that's mudita. And in that, there isn't a kind of separation. Sure, we're anthropomorphizing our love of chipmunks, I know that. But there isn't that kind of, there's a kind of connection to life. Nature does that. If you just stop and look at the shape of a tree, or now the colors of autumn, right? What does that do? That opens your heart in a way where you're connected. And beauty can do that. Beauty has this great power to open the heart. Trouble with beauty is we get attached to aesthetics. So then we become conceited or about beauty. But beauty in nature, beauty in other people. You know, just like noticing a person's goodness. And just, that's beautiful, is an opening of the heart. So I would suggest recognize that a lot, because it's just nice to do. But more deeply, when it goes the other way, you know, when it goes to closing the heart, heart's closing down to jealousy or cynicism or criticism, those kinds of things, what does that feel like? So now what you're doing is we're not just kind of caught up with the storylines of, oh, it was a beautiful autumn day. We're kind of connecting more to that which is with life in a wholesome and unegotistical way, and that which enters into life in an egotistical way. We're going to see that as moods of the mind. And this is one way of considering Cittanupassana, the third foundation of mindfulness, the awareness of the mood of the mind, the aramana or arom in Thai. And that kind of willingness to do that, I think, really touches the core of your suffering. Because those deep issues that we have, where we're not connected to things and to people, where the egotistical part of us comes up, that's what we have to address, don't we? You can have an abstract teaching of Four Noble Truths, Three Characteristics, it's all very well and good, but if it's not serving my suffering and my predicament, my conditioning, then what's the point of it? It's just sort of some kind of abstract theory. So rather than chasing some mode of enlightenment, which I think I should get, why not just look at the suffering that I have? And that's the first noble truth. All the time, right? Not just a kind of meditation session. So contemplate that. What is connected? What is kind? What is good? In the suttas, there's so much of that, isn't there? Like Metta Sutta, we're supposed to have, I mean, check this out now. We're supposed to have the same kind of affection and love a mother has for her only child. We're supposed to have that for everyone. It's not possible. You know, but the man says, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. So the bar is very, very high. And you can feel terribly inadequate with that. And God, again, I don't even love my dog. I'm hopeless. But what it reflects to me is all forms of alienation are not appropriate for the path. Not appropriate. And there's so much around the suttas about how our emotional life evolves. So goodwill is that kind of basic attitude that I wish no harm to any being. That's the definition of metta that I find the best. Because even if I'm not getting along with someone and they're, you know, making me angry or fearful, do I wish them ill will? Or do I wish them goodwill? And this is very, very important in speech. You know, when we're talking about other people, it's a dangerous area. And if we get drawn into, talking about people in ways which are unskillful, sometimes we say unskillful things. So it's always good to consider, is this from goodwill? So we will talk about each other, and we need to sometimes, but is this for the benefit of myself and others? Is this for the harmony of others? Because if we don't, what that does, it creates fear in our minds, and it also creates fear in the community, creates disharmony in the community. So goodwill is like, and well, I don't think, it's very hard to get that one right constantly. Let me give it a go. And if you take a very high standard, that the affection, you know, my mother had for me, and one of the things I realized taking care of my mother, the love she had for me, I could not even get close to it. Her love for me was far, far, I couldn't fathom it, it was so deep. I loved her deeply, but I just sensed in her, there was this other dimension of motherhood, which I've never experienced this time around. I don't know if I want to repeat, try it, if it's worth it. But you know, so the Buddha kind of presents a very, very profound connection. And when you read about the great mystics, if you read about any of the great attained beings, their sense of compassion is total. There's no difference. There's no difference. So, you know, the bar is very high. But how do we do that without feeling guilty? Is we take responsibility for those forms of alienation. And we recognize when the heart is open, oh yeah, this is what the Buddha's talking about. This is connection. You know, this is love when we connect to things. Not love as something smarmy, but something where the sense of ego falls away. And then karuna is that, you know, the beautiful compassion that we can experience for other beings. And that's active. You know, goodwill is an attitude. Compassion is activity, so it might be in terms of generosity, caregiving, whatever. That's the active component of our life. So Buddhism isn't just a kind of passive hanging out in equanimity. It has this really strong active component of caring for others. And I think if we don't have activity based on compassion and generosity, I do think we can become rather sterile. You're rather sterile, and I can certainly, you know, sense it in monastic communities where the ethos becomes one of maybe always running away and not serving, not in our monasteries, but sometimes that happens. And you can see sometimes monastics will become quite selfish about their territory, their turf, their jhana, their meditation, and I haven't seen good results of that. Whereas I think the monks that I've seen who have really served, like Lompa Cha, and Lompa Samedo, and Lompa Pasana, and Lompa Son, all these peers that I have, I sense a great deal of joy in them. They're good meditators, but they also have the joy of an expressive life, you know, a life of giving. And so dana and compassion and so on, these are very important elements in an energetic lifestyle, because we are energy beings. We're not just kind of passive contemplatives. We have energy, and that's it can be very, very wholesome, very helpful. And then mudita. Mudita is that, again, you see it in nature. You know, if you see something like the deer that run around here, even though they carry ticks, and several people got Lyme disease, it's hard to hate them. I mean, they just have the cute factor, I realize, but you know, there is something that opens, that isn't critical, that isn't judgmental, that appreciates. And that's a very important aspect of consciousness to get in touch with. Otherwise, the meditation can be like very, you know, it's kind of like, I'm always just working on myself. I'm always working on myself. And it becomes very narcissistic, self-absorbed, selfish in some kind of non-spiritual, spiritual way. So just that opening, where you're not thinking about yourself. You know, we're just with the clouds. Just the openness of the mind to nature, the wind, those kinds of things. Those are very healthy things to exercise the heart with. And then upekkha. Upekkha is that very difficult upekkha. Equanimity is very difficult. It's the mind which is open-hearted, but not caught in the reactions to sense experience. And these four go together. So upekkha, equanimity, is not cold indifference, because it includes compassion, it includes joy, it includes goodwill. So it's a kind of open-hearted coexistence and peace with the way things are. And that's hard to do. It's very, very hard to do, isn't it? It's very hard. So the Buddhist teaching is tough. You know, it's not kind of, you just kind of believe in the Buddha and you're done. It's much more difficult than that. And these heart practices or trainings or suggestions that we do are paramount to a joyous spiritual life, because if you don't open the heart, the heart needs that, you know. The whole meditative life begins to sour and become like self-analysis or striving for something or feeling frustrated. Whereas that open heart, generosity and giving, is gives you the kind of fuel of uplift to keep working on the difficult bits, you know, the ugly bits, the unpleasant bits of your consciousness that we're all working on. So love is a, you know, love is a funny word in English. I love Santana, or I love potato chips, or I like Thai food, or I love Thai food, or whatever, right? So it's a very almost useless word, because it can mean so many things, passion, so on. But these are the ways that you might think about that aspect of love in from Buddhist perspective. So where does passion come in there? Well, passion is a part of the biological part of our life. You know, there's like physical passion, sensual passion, those kinds of things. There's the kind of curious chemistry that some people have between themselves. And where that is enhanced is in the letting go of ego, right? Where that's enhanced, where it's sours is when the ego is not recognized and not let go of. So how does love transform into kind of good friendship, good kalyanamitta? And so kalyanamitta perhaps is the ultimate relationship. It's not one of marriage or non-marriage. It's not one of passion or non-passion. It's like the Brahma Vihara is always operating with the person you're with and the love of Dhamma. That's kalyanamitta. So kalyanamitta, which is spiritual friend, is a kind of concern for the welfare of another person, an empathy for the welfare of another person, which comes up practically when the person is happy. You have mudita. When the person is suffering, you try to do your utmost to help them. You always have goodwill towards them, but you're also peaceful with their karma, And the imagery around a mother, they talk about that in around the Brahma Viharas. They say a mom always has goodwill for her child, always wishes the very, very best for her child. And when the child, falls and bruises her knee, then the mom rushes and, you know, blows on the knee, or whatever moms do for little knees, does some kind of compassionate act, always caring. And if the child is successful, the mom's overjoyed. And the toughest one, is that the mom realizes that this little being has their own karma, that they will have successes and failures, that they will be happy and sad, that they will have gain and loss, that they will have sickness, and they will learn their lessons in life. And that's upekkha, or equanimity, accepting that each of us has our own kind of karmic thing. And that's very hard to do, very, very hard to do. I mean, I've not had kids, so I've not had that strong attachment to little beings. But from what I've seen, it's very hard not to worry about children and get caught up in their karma in some kind of way. And just finally, one of the things that you find in the text, the Buddha says to pick up someone, to not pick up your own karma is foolish. And to pick up someone else's karma is foolish. And karma is like just the idea that each of us is evolving spiritual qualities, each of us has challenges, and as much as I would like for you not to suffer, I can only advise, guide, offer some nurturing and so on, but then you have to learn your own lessons in life. And so upekā is that kind of peaceful, open-hearted coexistence with all things. And that's very helpful. Because for me to worry about other people's worries makes, you know, compounds worry, doesn't it? Worried squared. And yet to be peaceful with other people's worry, then I can try to offer some goodness from my own heart. So do, you know, I would really suggest look at your own practice in terms of the heart and see where those elements come in. You know, where does goodwill come in, and where does it get lost? And learn how to go to the open heart more and more. Then you'll find that you'll answer life very well. If you stay with the open heart, my sense is that life's challenges you'll answer the best you possibly can. Because you're really available. When the heart is open that way, you're really, really, really available. And the other, always being caught up in controlling and programming and so on, quite often you're not available. You're kind of judging situations already. Okay, so I'll leave that for your reflection.
Andamayang dhamma gathaya sadhu karang dadamase.